Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, December 22nd, 2005.
Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Chris Andre. Coming up, Providence Health Systems paid its former president and CEO more than $1 million in wages and bonuses last year. The Senate has agreed to extend the USA Patriot Act by 6 months. And in Nabla in Palestine and Israel, three Palestinian militants were killed today in an Israeli attack on Nablus. Portland area weather, heavy rain or freezing rain, windy in the gorge, highs in the 40s, more rain tonight, lows in the mid-30s to low 40s.
Providence Health Systems, Providence Health Systems paid former president and chief executive officer Hank Walker more than $1 million in wages and bonuses last year. This when he worked 2 months before retiring. The charitable tax-exempt hospital system also paid Walker almost $7 million in retirement money. The payout comes at a time of intensifying scrutiny of the business practices of nonprofit hospitals. It raises questions whether they are serving the charitable missions they exempt that exempt them from paying taxes. Providence officials say they are paying no more than the market price for competent leaders. Independent surveys show that multimillion-dollar salaries are no longer unusual for nonprofit hospital chiefs. Still, Congress, the IRS, and Attorney General in several states, including Oregon, are taking a closer look at how nonprofits reward executives. IRS Commissioner Mark Everson this year warned tax-exempt organizations of a gathering storm of enforcement efforts, including a crackdown on excessive compensation. Nonprofit executives whose pay exceeds market rates can be fined and forced to pay back their organizations, and boards that approve such compensation packages can be fined.
Oregon authorities want to isolate contaminated soil around Ross Island's lagoon under thousands of tons of clean dirt. The move would end the final chapter in the Portland site's contentious environmental history. This from the Oregonian. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality announced yesterday that chemical-laden soil at the former gravel mine operated by Ross Island Sand and Gravel Company will be covered over by at least 3 feet of clean earth to keep carcinogens from spreading. The agency also said it would require actions to maintain and monitor earthen caps now in place on the site's chemical burial zones to make sure they remain stable.
According to the Oregonian, Portland truck maker Freightliner LLC has announced plans to lay off 130 workers. The company cites the need to juggle the mix of trucks produced at its Swan Island plant. Freightliner Chief Operating Officer Roger Nielsen said the reduction effective today was necessary because the company plans to build fewer Western Star trucks and more Freightliner branded trucks next year. All are considered Class 8 or heavy duty trucks, but Freightliner brand trucks, including the Coronado, Columbia, and Century class vehicles favored by fleet operators and independent truckers, require less manpower to build than the Western Star rigs, which are bulkier and often used in the construction and logging industry.
Yesterday was the first day of winter, a cold reminder for the thousands of Oregon families who can't afford to pay to keep a roof over their heads. A recent report shows minimum wage workers have little chance of finding affordable housing in Oregon. KBOO's Sheila Whiteside reports.
Wednesday is the first day of winter, and for many Oregon families, including thousands of children, the winter cold is even more cruel because they find themselves without a place to live. A report released this month from the National Low Income Housing Coalition shows a low-wage worker in Oregon has a little chance of finding affordable housing. Martha McLennan with Northwest Housing Alternatives says that leaves almost 2,000 kids in Clackamas County alone homeless.
It's critical for the livability of Oregon to continue for us to be able to provide for people that cannot keep up with these prices.
The fair market average rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Oregon is $682 a month. When utilities are included, Oregonians earning the minimum wage would have to work two jobs to pay the bills.
Portlanders haven't seen a ghetto yet, and that's the path that Portland's going to take if there isn't any funding for housing. You're talking about a very small sum of money that in the long term is going to benefit all of us in the state.
Content was provided by Oregon News Service. I'm Sheila Whiteside, KBOO News.
Portland General Electric hopes to return its Boardman power plant to operation by February 1st. A faulty rotor forced PGE to shut down the efficient coal-fired plant October 22nd. Crews hoisted the 55-ton component onto a massive cargo plane for shipment to the East Coast for repairs. The utility has asked the Oregon Public Utility Commission for permission to track the costs of replacement power, and at a later date, bill consumers for the expense. PGE estimates that the replacement power could cost the utility and its ratepayers an extra $46 million or more if the shutdown continues past January 31st. The Boardman shutdown has forced PGE to rely more heavily on its stable of natural gas-fired plants. These have become increasingly expensive as gas prices have reached unprecedented heights. The PUC likely won't decide for several months whether to let PGE charge customers for the expense.
The ACLU has released documents obtained from a Freedom of Information suit that show federal law enforcement officers put several activist groups under surveillance in the wake of 9/11. Included in the list of groups that underwent special scrutiny was an animal rights group, a Catholic social work organization, and a group that advocates for the rights of Arab Americans. The California Report's Judy Campbell has more on the fallout from the release of the papers.
Jeff Dietrich has spent 35 years with the Los Angeles Catholic Workers on Hollywood's Skid Row.
We do the work of Jesus Christ. We feed the hungry, clothe the naked, shelter the homeless.
In 2001, Dietrich and others were arrested after trespassing at Vandenberg Air Force Base in a semi-annual protest of the nation's missile defense system. FBI counterterrorism documents say any trespass that might delay a missile test launch would cost at least $1 million and damage the public image of the defense system. Ben Weiser is the ACLU attorney who sued for the documents.
No one is making the argument that these groups should be immune from any law enforcement scrutiny. But the question is, should counterterrorism resources be devoted to doing that? And should these groups have to bear the label of domestic terrorists because of their ideology?
The FBI documents reveal surveillance of mainstream organizations such as Greenpeace and refer to a list of participants at a Stanford conference on Iraq. The Catholic Workers' Dietrich says he finds it all frightening.
I'll tell you what I feel is, at a certain point, if there's another terrorist attack, then people like me, who are basically nonviolent but critical of government policy, run the risk of being rounded up, or at least hounded. That's my deepest fear.
The FBI didn't respond to a request for an interview, but in a statement, the agency says surveillance was conducted only as part of a criminal or terrorism investigation and is always predicated on specific information. The FBI documents were released a week after NBC News revealed a Pentagon database that kept tabs on anti-war groups and called the UC Santa Cruz group's plan to protest military recruiters on campus a credible threat. For the California Report, I'm Judy Campbell.
Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald is not expected to shut down his investigation into the leak of covert CIA officer Valerie Plame Wilson when he finishes his inquiry of White House Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove's role in the leak, according to the Raw story. Sources indicate that if a grand jury returns an indictment against Rove, it will include, at the very least, a charge that he made false statements to Justice Department and FBI investigators when he was first interviewed about his role in the case in October 2003. Fitzgerald is still investigating other unnamed White House officials. The investigation is expected to shift back to top officials in the office of the Vice President, the State Department, and the National Security Council. It may even shed some light on the genesis of the Niger forgeries. The forged documents were cited in President Bush's 2003 State of the Union address. More than 24 people from the White House have been interviewed or testified before the grand jury since Fitzgerald was tapped to lead the investigation 2 years ago. Some of these people, who were senior level, have cooperated with the prosecutor in exchange for immunity related to their role in the case. No plea deals have been entered into with any official. This from the Raw story.
A Democrat-led filibuster yesterday blocked the passage of a bill that includes language opening up Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. One of the Senate's most powerful members, Republican Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, has been advocating oil drilling in the refuge for the last 25 years. Stevens angered senators on both sides of the aisle by attaching the legislation to a bill that includes funding for troops in Iraq and victims of Hurricane Katrina. The Senate blocked the opening the nation's largest untapped oil reserve in the Alaska Wildlife Refuge and delivered a victory to environmentalists and others who say drilling would threaten wildlife. Senator Maria Cantwell, Democrat of Washington, led the floor debate in opposition to the drilling provision. Cantwell called it a legislative blackmail and said Democrats agreed they were not going to get jammed by the tactic. The measure was widely expected to be withdrawn and reworked without the refuge language. Democrats, as well as a number of Republicans, were already angered by Stevens' tactic that delayed action on the $453.5 billion defense bill. The bill includes $29 billion for hurricane relief, money for the war and border security, and $2 billion to help low-income households pay this winter's heating expenses. After the vote, Democrats celebrated, as did environmentalists, knowing they had tangled with one of the Senate's toughest members and won.
According to the New York Times, the Senate breathed new life late Wednesday into the moribund USA Patriot Act, agreeing to extend it by 6 months. President Bush said he appreciated the move, but it was unclear if the House would approve it. With 16 major provisions of the act set to expire on December 31st, the Senate action put an end to a game of brinksmanship between that partisan coalition and Bush. Bush had repeatedly vowed to oppose any short-term extension of the act, but Republican aides said the White House had signed off on the Senate deal. The bill's future now rests with the House, which comes back into session Thursday. The Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist of Tennessee said he had not consulted the House leaders. The Senate action came after a day of frantic negotiations in the Capitol and a stern admonishment from the president, who warned yesterday morning that the nation would be vulnerable to a terrorist attack if the act's major provisions were permitted to lapse. The Patriot Act has provoked intense debate about the proper balance between protecting national security and civil liberties. The House passed an updated version of the 2001 bill last week, but that measure got bottled up in the Senate.
A U.S. appeals court acting in the case of alleged enemy combatant Jose Padilla has rejected the administration's move to avoid another Supreme Court review of its powers of detention. A federal appeals court yesterday backed the president's power to indefinitely detain a U.S. citizen captured on U.S. soil without any criminal charges. The court held that such authority is vital during wartime to protect the nation from terrorist attacks. Yesterday, the panel rejected both requests. Its actions revive the possibility that the High Court will review the Padilla case and at least give the justices the opportunity to review it. The Bush administration has sought to avoid this action. The appeals court opinion reflected a tone of anger that is rare for a federal court addressing the United States government, particularly in the matter of presidential authority. The chain of events leading to the court's ruling began more than 3.5 years ago when the government seized Padilla at the airport, claiming he was plotting a dirty bomb attack in the United States in connection with Al-Qaeda. It never charged him with such a plot in any court, but transferred him to a brig in Charleston, South Carolina, where he was denied a lawyer until a threatened Supreme Court intervention. Padilla's lawyers say the appeal twice, losing on technical grounds at the Supreme Court in 2004. Yesterday's ruling changed the course of events in the trial once again.
Threatened with huge fines and possible jail time, the New York Transit Union suggested yesterday that it would be willing to end its strike if a plan to change workers' pensions were dropped. The contract covering 33,000 New York Transit workers expired last week, and the union called the strike Tuesday morning despite a state law banning public employee strikes. The judge in the case said he hoped there might be a breakthrough in the mediated talks overnight. Still, the city was making plans to serve legal papers ordering union members to return to work.
California's top election official will ask the federal government to review the security of software used with Diebold electronic voting machines and to investigate claims that results could be vulnerable to hackers. This, according to Reuters. Diebold has been dogged by complaints while trying to certify its electronic voting machines for sale in California. County election officials in the state and other states are eager to upgrade paper-based voting systems to avoid controversies like that surrounding the recount of punch card ballots in Florida during the 2000 presidential election. Some groups, however, have questioned the security of electronic voting systems and are concerned about Diebold in particular. The company has been under fire from activists over former company chairman and chief executive Walden O'Dell's role in President Bush's re-election campaign in Ohio. Some charge that Diebold's voting systems are not as safe from tampering as the company claims. The elections watchdog group Black Box Voting has offered to California Secretary of State Bruce McPherson to arrange for a computer security consultant to attempt to hack a Diebold voting system. If certified quickly, the systems could be deployed by county officials for California's June 2006 election. A Diebold official said the company would cooperate with McPherson's request for a federal review and other certification requirements.
The mayor of Cincinnati, the Roman Catholic Archbishop, and a rabbi were among the religious and civic leaders who stood together yesterday to denounce the bombing of an Islamic center. Two explosive devices inflicted minor damage to the entrances of adjoining mosques Tuesday night, about 2 hours after the prayers had ended. No one was injured. Mayor Mark Mallory said, "We're all here in solidarity to speak out against this despicable act. From a community standpoint, we need to make it clear that this type of criminal activity will not be tolerated." Stan Borgia, the agent in charge of the FBI's Cincinnati office, said investigators had not finished analyzing debris from the scene. He declined to describe the bombs or their level of sophistication. Doorways at both mosques were damaged. The older building, a two-story brick house, is used for daily prayers. A worship center that opened 2 years ago is used for large gatherings of 300 to 400 families.
The infrastructure of New Orleans, both natural and human-made, has been stretched beyond the breaking point. This includes the court system, which was physically displaced and now operates with a workforce decimated by budget cuts. FSRN's Melinda Tuhu sat in on a recent morning session of municipal court, where some say justice has taken a big hit.
Almost 60 people were processed through Judge John Shea's courtroom in 90 minutes. They were charged with various misdemeanors, such as public intoxication, trespassing, and curfew violations. The public defender representing 50 of the accused who had spent the night in jail spoke to them as a group for a couple of minutes. He told them what they should expect if they pleaded guilty or not guilty. All but a handful pleaded guilty and had to pay a $200 or $300 fine. One of them was Larry Reed, a middle-aged African-American man who was arrested for violating the 6 a.m. curfew by a half hour. Some family members were in court to pay his fine. His cousin Doris Brown was outraged.
Say he was going down there where they look for work at, you know, hiring people to clean out houses and things. So I still can't understand why he had to pay the $200 for that length of time. Nobody has no money.
She says her family was in the Superdome and then shuffled around the country before returning to New Orleans.
Nobody has no money. Then we got to take your Social Security money and pay for a fine. That's unfair.
Judge Shea says before Hurricane Katrina, all the municipal courts together processed 90,000 cases a year. The numbers are much lower now because so many residents have not yet returned to the city. But Shea says the court still has to maintain law and order.
If they don't do this now, then it's going to just get out of hand. So the police feel that they have an obligation to enforce these kind of laws.
Public defender Norman Pettengill has worked with the Indigent Defender Program for the city of New Orleans since it was set up in 1971. He says it's frustrating work.
More and more people we have to represent and less time to do it, and it's getting a lot tougher. less resources, because nobody likes to give money to people who are charged with crimes. They forget about the little philosophy that they're innocent until proven guilty.
But New Orleans attorney Judson Mitchell says the court system is more than frustrating. It's corrupt, funding its operations by preying on poor people who have returned to New Orleans to work.
The court is more than happy to let them loose immediately upon them agreeing to pay a $300 fine within 48 hours, which they all do, regardless of whether or not they're guilty or not, because they need to get back out and get working to get money in their pockets and to rebuild our city. I hope this is not the way we want to start again. We've had a chance to rebuild, to renew.
Mitchell adds,
let's start by making our courts a little bit more honest.
For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Orleans.
The Ohio Patriot Act has made it to Governor Rob Taft's desk. If the Ohio governor signs it into law, it would most likely become the toughest terrorism bill in the country. The lengthy piece of legislation would let police arrest people in public places who will not give their names, address, and birth dates, even if they're not doing anything wrong. One state representative said it resembles Gestapo-style tactics of government, and there could be changes coming on the streets of Ohio's small town and big cities. It would also pave the way for everyone entering critical transportation sites such as train stations, airports, and bus stations to show ID. Kerry Davis of the ACLU says it brings us frighteningly close to a show-me-your-papers society. Governor Taft will make the ultimate decision on whether to sign the bill. Taft is expected to sign the bill into law, but legal experts expect that it will be challenged in courts.
Three Palestinian militants were killed today in an Israeli military operation in the West Bank town of Nablus. Troops entered the town in pursuit of wanted men and opened fire on a building where militants had holed up. One wanted man and two other militants were shot as they tried to flee. Military officials would not disclose the affiliation or identity of the men it was pursuing. Witnesses, however, said they belonged to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine.
Lebanon criticized U.S. demands yesterday that it hand over a Hezbollah hijacker released from Germany after nearly 19 years in jail for murdering an American. Prime Minister Fouad Siniora said Lebanon's judicial authorities were looking at the legal status of Muhammad Ali Hamadi. Hamadi was freed quietly last week and immediately returned to Lebanon despite objections from Washington. The U.S. has vowed to bring him from Lebanon to face a U.S. judge. Hamadi was sentenced to life imprisonment by a German court for his role in the 1985 hijacking of a TWA airliner and the murder of U.S. Navy diver Robert Dean Stethem in Beirut. Signora said Hamadi had served a term close to what he would have faced if he had been convicted in Lebanon. He also said the judiciary was exploring whether his crime was covered by a general amnesty after Lebanon's 1975 to 1990 civil war. The United States considers Hamadi a threat and wants to bring him before a U.S. judge to face further punishment, even though it does not have an extradition treaty with Lebanon. This according to Reuters.
Four Iraqi policemen were killed and six others wounded when gunmen opened fire on a police checkpoint in Baghdad today. This according to Reuters. The attack comes after a relative lull in violence in the Iraqi capital in recent days as Iraq sealed off its borders and shut down vehicular traffic during last week's parliamentary elections. Attacks on U.S. and Iraqi forces have resumed since the lockdown was lifted as the Sunni Arab-led insurgency continues to battle against the Shiite and Kurdish-led government. According to Reuters, Mexico is enlisting the help of its Latin American neighbor for a diplomatic assault against U.S. plans to build a high-security fence on parts of its Mexican border to keep out illegal immigrants. Foreign Minister Luis Arsenio Debes said yesterday that he'd spoken to the governments in Central America, Colombia, and the Dominican Republic at a summit meeting last week to ask them to oppose the fence. It's part of a bill in the U.S. Congress that will crack down on undocumented workers who send billions of dollars home every year and prop up the economies of Mexico and small Central American nations. The immigration reform has deeply upset Mexico, one of the few big countries in Latin America now not ruled by leftist presidents wary of Washington. President Vicente Fox has called the plan to build a fence with security cameras and lighting disgraceful and called on Americans to remember their nation was built by immigrants. The legislation, which has divided Republicans, would also make it harder for U.S. employers to hire illegal aliens and make it a felony to live in the United States illegally. The Senate is expected to take up the immigration reform in February, and Mexico has hired a public relations firm in the United States to convince senators to water down the plan.
Evo Morales has received numerous calls from Latin American leaders congratulating him on winning his presidential bid in Bolivia, but Mexican President Vicente Fox is not one of them. Mexico's Foreign Relations Secretary says he does not support Morales' plan of creating a Latin American trade bloc to counter the United States. Although it's only been 3 days since Morales was elected as the country's first indigenous president, Bolivian people are expecting their new president will institute the changes he has promised. FSRN's Dileta Varlis reports.
Evo Morales was elected last Sunday with 51% of votes, something that has never happened in Bolivian election before. The official tally will be given by National Electoral Court on Friday, but right now the votes for Morales are increasing day by day. That's an expression of a needing for a change expressed by the majority of Bolivians. Bolivia is full of hopes and expectation towards the person of Evo Morales as an indigenous leader representing the most exploited part of the society. There is a great trust in his party, MAS, which indicates that there has been deep change in the government class, and people are willing to bet on his political program, looking to country's interests and not to the business of a small rich minority. Andres Rodriguez is a taxi driver who says he voted for Morales.
I believe he can make it. He has character. He has faced so many difficulties during protests and blockades. He has no fear.
There are also people who do not trust him, especially people belonging to the upper middle class who fear their interests could be damaged by this new government. A few days before the elections, a series of signs appeared on the walls of homes in the richer southern part of La Paz. They read, "If Morales wins, this house will be taken for social use." Ramiro Gonzalez is a businessman who voted for the other candidate, Tuto Quiroga.
Morales has to do what he promised, because he pressured previous administrations on these issues. So now he has to deliver. I hope he manages to, but I don't believe he can. I think he'll drag this country to hell. With Quiroga, we had more possibilities, since he's supported by the U.S., but Morales is not. With what kind of competence can he lead?
The issue.
That was FSRN's Dileta Varlis reporting. This has been the Cable Morning News for Thursday, December 22nd, 2005. Chris Andre edited the news, KBOO's volunteer audio engineers edited the tape, and KBOO's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director, and Becca Bartleson is on the board right now. I'm Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Chris Andre.
We welcome your participation to this in this program. To volunteer, call us at 503-231-8032. Reach us by email, www.kboo.org. Or drop by the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Check out the new improved website at www.kboo.fm. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis, on translator K264 AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220 HR. Be sure to join us at 5 PM for a solid hour of news on the KBOO Evening News. Coming up later on today at 7:30, Joanne Bowman and Alan Graff host Talk Radio and take your calls on all kinds of topics. At 9 on the Radio Zine, Marlene Howell interviews local activist Ruth Kovas on her new book, a poetry book called Help Wanted, A Poor People's Perspective of Poverty. Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, The News You're Not Supposed to Know, at 10 on it's part two of Will Seaman's series on Israel-Palestine. His guest is professor and radical Israeli historian Ilan Pappe on the Gaza evacuation. At 10:30, Portland artist Tom Kramer, guest host Art Focus. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Portland area weather, heavy rain or freezing rain, windy in the gorge, highs in the 40s, more rain tonight, lows in the mid-30s to low 40s.